And as I did yesterday, I want to just say a brief word about the scriptural reference that kind of locates this particular theme and this particular set of reflections about communities of gratitude and generosity. So the full verse from Hebrews 12:28 says, "Therefore, since we are receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, let us give thanks, by which we offer to God an acceptable worship with reverence and awe." And I think that verse is in keeping with the biblical view that we noted yesterday about a different kind of social order that the church's worship bears witness to. For the Hebrews writer, it's a kingdom that cannot be shaken, kind of a confident way of putting that reality into words. Again, a different arrangement of social relationships, a different body politic, right? An alternative vision of human community and of the wielding of power. This kingdom that cannot be shaken. What we've already said, God's mission of shalom in the world, God's mission of reconciliation and healing, of abundance and hospitality. And because of this kingdom that cannot be shaken, we give thanks, the Hebrews writer says. And worship, acceptable worship, flows out of that gratitude. And gratitude flows out of worship. Worship and gratitude. Gratitude and worship are mutually informing this kind of endless circle of praise and thanksgiving. And that's it, isn't it? The biblical view of worship. And this is missional worship. We are a people whose common life is characterized by gratitude and generosity. We are a people whose common life is characterized by gratitude and generosity. But as soon as I say that, and as soon as you hear that, we're probably struck by something, which is that being a people of gratitude and generosity is not how the church is perceived and regarded in our culture, is it? Gratitude and generosity are typically not the first things that come to mind when people outside of the church think about what Christianity is. You probably know the statistics, something like 85% of millennials, that generation born after 1980, 85% associate Christianity not with gratitude and generosity, but with hypocrisy and judgmentalism, right? And I think a good deal of what was lamented in our communal psalms last night was exactly this state of affairs in the church, right? We're divided. We're suspicious of one another. We're enemies rather than friends. We are decidedly not grateful too often. We are decidedly not generous. So we don't seem to be known by the wider culture as a people of gratitude and generosity. And even we who serve the church, and maybe especially those of us who serve the church, we don't seem to see and experience much gratitude and generosity either. Which begs the obvious question, right? Why? Why is that? First, I think we shouldn't discount the communities, the people, and places of Christian witness who have indeed gotten this right, who have, in fact, made gratitude and generosity their way of life. We can be so cynical and despairing sometimes, I think, we can forget that there are these pockets and places and often people at the edges of the institutional church who, in fact, have gotten this quite right. And I hope that you know some communities like that. Traditional churches, perhaps, or maybe intentional, experimental kinds of communities that live out these lives of gratitude and generosity in rich, creative, compelling ways. And I also hope that even if your own worshiping community, like my own, struggles to get this right, struggles to be and to bear witness to gratitude and generosity, that even in those places, our places, by the grace of God, there are glimpses and there are small gestures and practices of gratitude and generosity that we can note and be thankful for. And so that cynicism and despair doesn't overtake us in thinking about this. What I'd like us to ponder as our question for this session, and again, I'll just kind of read it out, and you'll let it hover in the background, and we may not have time to talk about it in our large group, but as the occasion arises around your table conversations, maybe you can explore this question together, which is this. Specifically, concretely, where have you seen gratitude and generosity lived out in your own ecclesial settings? Specifically, concretely, where have you seen gratitude and generosity lived out in your own ecclesial settings? Still, we have to reckon with this troubling truth that gratitude and generosity don't seem to be normative for Christians in the way that they should be. They seem too often to be exceptions rather than the rule. And again, it's easy to be cynical and discouraged, and it's very easy to sort of begin to pile on our complaints, right? But we are a people of hope, not despair. And we are called to trust not in our own power to make this happen, to sort of be witnesses of gratitude and generosity. To trust not in our own power, but in the reconciling work of God in Christ. To bring life out of dry bones, to bring fresh insight, to help us learn or relearn the ways of the kingdom, the ways of God's mission in the world. And we'll come to that idea at the end again. We don't do this by our own power. Thank God for that. While we could probably generate quite a list of reasons why gratitude and generosity don't seem to define the church's common life, I suggest that one way to get at this, one way to frame this kind of troubling reality, is to see it as a failure of imagination. So we're coming back to that word imagination again. And again, this idea of our inability to picture, portray, receive, and practice this alternative vision of God's shalom in the world, this alternative vision that we glimpse and share in and participate in the worshiping body. Yesterday, you'll recall, we talked about Eucharist as an imaginative act, an embodied, enacted pattern or paradigm of abundance and goodness. And as we eat the bread and drink the cup week after week, season after season, year after year, our character is shaped. Gratitude and generosity become constitutive of who we are as God's witnesses in the world. Except when they don't. Except when we fail to live into and out of this new reality, this embodied and acted paradigm or pattern of abundance and goodness. So failure of imagination, we'll come to that too. So today, as in yesterday, I want to talk about three themes. And we've also got a little clip of a film I want to show, about 12 or 15 minutes or so of a movie. I'll set that up in a minute. But the three themes for today, number one, the table of abundance. We'll be echoing and sort of picking up some of the themes from yesterday and talking about Eucharist. So the first theme, the table of abundance, this site at which gratitude and generosity are embodied, literally enacted, and the site from which we are then sent out to be a grateful, generous people. So the first theme, the table of abundance. The second theme, why we often fail at this so badly. And the third theme, where there's hope. So the table of abundance, number one. Number two, why we often fail. And number three, where there's hope. Because there's always, always hope. So the table of abundance, this first theme. Again, our discussion yesterday of the Eucharist. At a table of plenty, of rich bounty, Christ welcomes us and feeds us. And since we have freely received, therefore we may freely give. From the table we are sent out to welcome and feed others. In the Eucharist, we hand over the first fruits of our labor, and we receive back the first fruits of the resurrection, of abundant life in Christ. So what reason is there not to be generous? If we fully take in that truth, that reality, what reason is there not to be generous? God is generous. How can we not be generous? God gives without conditions and without demands. Why can't we? God delights in giving. Why don't we? God gives, as theologian Miroslav Volf puts it, God gives so that we can become joyful givers and not just self-absorbed receivers. God gives so that we can become joyful givers and not just self-absorbed receivers. So this table of abundance, of welcome and plenty and bounty, stands in judgment against all forms of stinginess and deprivation, of paucity and lack. There's more than enough. As often as we eat this bread and drink this cup, we receive, as St. Augustine said, the very mystery of ourselves, our identity as the body of Christ. We are taken, blessed, broken, and shared with a suffering world. This table of abundance makes us friends with God, who desires our fellowship, who delights in communing with us. We talked yesterday about worship being our disposition as creatures. We're liturgical beings created for communion with our Creator. From Genesis to Revelation, we know, we hear the story over and over. God creates us for fellowship with God's own self. And friendship is one way that we name that. And friendship with God, communion with God, finds its expression in friendship with others, with one another. Right? And friends, real friends, practice gratitude for the gift of the other. Friends are generous with one another. So, as an avenue into sort of making this a little more concrete, a little more specific, I want to draw your attention to this film. And the clip we're going to see is from the movie Babette's Feast. Have some of you seen that before? Hopefully many of you, maybe all of you, are familiar with it. It's based on a short story by Isak Dinesen, a Danish writer. She also wrote the story, the film of which was made Out of Africa. Might have seen that, made back in the 80s, I think. But Babette's Feast tells the story of this very austere Danish Christian sect that very carefully shuns the sensual delights of this world. And Babette, who is this star chef and a refugee from a counter-revolutionary situation in Paris, she comes to live among this dwindling congregation who know nothing about her past, who don't know that she's been this famed Parisian chef. She lives there for some 14 years, I think, and is taught to prepare the very spare, austere, simple foods of this Danish sect living kind of on the edge of the coast, where they eat a lot of cod and ale bread soup. Years passed. What was that?
Oh, yummy.
Yummy. Yeah, and if you've seen the scenes of that food in the film and then the sumptuous feast at the end, it's striking, that contrast. So years pass, and Babette, who's been playing the lottery every year that she's been in Denmark, she wins 10,000 francs, and she decides to spend all the money on this sumptuous feast, this banquet, that will celebrate the occasion of the 100th anniversary of the founder of this community. But again, this congregation who's very much afraid of the sin of sensuality and too much luxury in life, they're nervous about this. And they decide that they'll eat this meal because they don't want to be rude to Babette, but they're not going to enjoy it. They're not going to take any pleasure in it. And they vow not to mention anything about the food during the dinner. But as you watch this scene unfold, they cannot help but be overcome by this meal, by this absolute feast of generosity. And so gradually their frigid selves and their careful facades begin to melt. old hostilities are repaired, old loves are rekindled. We have to watch a lot more to get the fullness of that. But that's what this meal does. That's what this meal of generosity does. And Babette, her gift is a symbol of Christ's self-emptying and Christ's call to this table of abundance. And this congregation gradually accepts, despite their resistance, that God's grace is not finite, is not limited, is not stingy, but is lavishly spread out over all of creation. And so they're invited to a meal that in its celebration of God's creation and redemption offers a glimpse of this new world in which sins are forgiven and wrongs are righted and all that is divided is healed. This very mission of shalom. So that's the backdrop. Let me pull up this. If somebody can put the light, maybe that might be good.
Babette siger, vi er klar.
Jamen så, lad os da gå til bords.
Ja.
Thank you.
finale et pour le général Vergandé à Tante. Demandez un stage des modèles.
Paris vann jag en gång en ridkonkurrens och blev därefter firad av de franska kavalleriofficerarna med en middag på en av stans modernaste restauranger, Café Anglais. Där kökschefen förbluffade en ovan kvinna. Vi fick Kai en sarkofage. En rätt som hon själv komponerade. General Galifé, som var värd för kvällen, förklarade att denna kvinna, denna kökschef, var kapabel att förvandla en måltid till en slags kärleksaffär. Ett älskosförhåll där man inte längre kunde skilja mellan fysisk och adelig aptit. General Galifé berättade att han förr utkämpat dueller för en vacker kvinnas skull. Men att det nu inte längre fanns någon kvinna i Paris för vilken han ville utgjuta sitt blod, utom för denna köksfev. Och var känd som tidens största kulinariska fri. Det vi nu äter är just Kai en sarkofage.
Halleluja.
Kai en sarkofage.
Ja, det är det.
Skal ikke bare afstå fra, men også nægte enhver tanke på mad og drikke. Først da kan han spise og drikke i den rette ånd.
Det eneste, vi får lov til at tage med fra dette jordeliv, er det, vi har givet bort.
De kære to, de bliver rige i det næste liv.
Struck how this film made by a very secular filmmaker based on a short story by a very secular writer is the most Eucharistic thing I've ever seen on the screen. Just stunning. But even this little clip that we just saw, I think, shows this contrast between the competing narratives of scarcity and abundance, right, that we've been talking about, the between fear and joy. This feast that comes near the end of this movie, imagines a different kind of human community, an alternative ordering of human relationships, everything we've been talking about. This transformed community encounters fulfillment and abundance in this most basic bodily act of eating together, of eating and drinking, which ends up being so much more than eating and drinking. And it's ultimately, isn't it, an experience of grace, which every Eucharist is. God's gracious and grace-filled ways with us call forth gratitude. And God's generosity toward us stirs in us a desire to be generous with each other, to forgive and to reconcile, to care for, to tend to love without condition. And in this story, excuse me, Babette herself first receives the gift of hospitality. She shows up on a dark and stormy night in this village. If you've seen the movie, she kind of comes in. She's all wrapped in a cloak. And it's this misty evening on this Danish coast. And these sisters take her in. She's the recipient of their graciousness, their hospitality. And then Babette, in turn, in her own gratitude, offers her gifts to others. She, like Christ in the Eucharist, is both guest and host. She's the guest in this village, but she's the host of this feast. And also, like Christ, her kenotic gift, her self-emptying gift, doesn't paradoxically leave her empty. She has nurtured herself in the giving of it. And when you see the end of this movie, and I probably shouldn't give too much away if you haven't seen it, she's deeply satisfied. It's the most fulfilling experience of her life to have done this, to have given everything. She's complete. And also what's interesting about the story and the movie is that the sisters don't realize that Babette has spent her entire lottery winnings on this meal. And there's also this marvelous scene early on when all the food is brought in, and you see the big turtle that the soup is made from, and he's still alive at that point. And you see all the quail, right? The quail in the coffin, that dish that they talk about. That's just a little bit theological, isn't it? In a grave. You see this procession of food come in, and it's almost like the offertory. It's almost like the procession to the table with this abundance of food. So the sisters don't realize that she has shot her wad. She has spent it all. They think she's going to take this money and go back to Paris, right? Go back to where the action is. Go back to where life is. But Babette, this artist, this giver, is complete. She is spent, literally, but she is full. And like Babette, the body gathered at the table of abundance imitates Christ in its own acts of generosity, when gratitude for the gifts of God overflow outward to neighbor, to stranger, to enemy, to friend. So why don't we do this? Our second point, why do we so often fail at this? And again, we could likely come up with a long list of reasons why generosity and gratitude don't seem to define our common life. Our churches are consumed with inner turmoil, right? We have endless arguments about ordination, about gays and lesbians, about pension funds and aging facilities. We're just consumed with our own sort of inner turmoils. Too many of our churches are consumed with bureaucracy and with self-preservation, right? How to save the institutional forms of the church in a dying Christendom. Again, we've presumed as an institutional church scarcity rather than abundance, so we're more concerned about protecting our resources, our assets, than giving them away. And you could name other reasons. We could go on and on, but I don't want us to, because that could get a bit despairing. But I'll name three reasons why I think we do often fail at this, and then again offer three reasons for hope. But as I said earlier, the failure of imagination seems to be at work here. We don't seem to have eyes to see what's in front of us. That we have already been given everything that we need. That the table has been prepared. We are invited We are fed. We are transformed. But we have failed to cultivate that capacity to imagine, which means not just thinking it, but living it, practicing this alternative way of being abundant and sharing and generous in the world. And maybe one of the reasons for this failure of imagination is that we've, for generations, for centuries, in some Christian circles, we've considered the Lord's Supper a kind of private meal for me, right? Me and Jesus kind of communing ourselves, rather than this communal banquet, rather than this foretaste of the heavenly feast at which we all share in. And I think that's what's so beautiful in this film. I can talk all day, and we can sort of hash out in our conversation that the Eucharist really is a foretaste of the heavenly banquet. But when you see it, when you see it sort of visually portrayed, that it's a communal meal. It's not just a private meal for me. I also think maybe one of the reasons for this failure of imagination is the very ways that we commune at the Lord's table. The logistics, if you will, of how we take the meal stifles our imagination. If we have a little paltry, skimpy piece of bread, a little cracker, a little piece of a cracker, and a little tiny shot glass of grape juice, that's not conducive, is it, to this notion of abundance and sharing? The one loaf, the one body, the one cup, the one community. So the very practical, physical, tangible ways that we actually consume this meal can work against our seeing it as this bountiful sharing, this generous meal of gratitude. So the failure of imagination as one of the reasons for our inability to make gratitude and generosity kind of our default way of living. A second reason, I think we often assume that generosity and gratitude or any virtue or any fruit of the Spirit that we could name has to be cultivated and practiced by our own power, in our own strength, through our own cleverness and ingenuity. We've got to muster it from deep within ourselves. We've got to conjure it from our own being, right? We are such workaholic overachievers, we've deluded ourselves into thinking that we have to make it happen. Right? That gratitude and generosity are our own accomplishments. And that we're responsible for cultivating gratitude and generosity among the people in our congregations. I'm going to make you generous. I'm going to make you grateful, right? I mean, we just sort of seem to be, in many ways, those kinds of people. That if we just design the right experience, the right liturgy, the right kind of worship practice or innovation, then, by God, our people will be grateful and generous, and we will have done our work. So this idea that it's all up to us, we have to figure this out. And it's true, I think, as we've been saying all along, that worship is the place where we are shaped to be a people of gratitude and generosity, but not because we've engineered the liturgy in such a way as to make that happen. One of the things I didn't get to say yesterday when I was talking about James Allison, the Catholic theologian who I'm very captivated by, who writes about worship and a lot of other things, he makes this point. We don't have to do liturgy right in order to make something happen. Jesus is already there. He already promised to be there. Our only task is to show up, is to habitually make ourselves present as the worshiping body to that sacramental grace, to be present to the one who's just there. We don't have to whip up emotions. We don't have to conjure in people the right kinds of dispositions or attitudes. We just have to create the conditions for the Spirit's work to be present in that promised space. And so Allison has, again, I think, this compelling insight, especially for us workaholic Protestants, right? That Christian worship is predicated on the understanding that there's nothing left to achieve or accomplish. The kingdom that is unshakable, right, from the Hebrews writer's perspective, has already been inaugurated. We're participants in it, not creators of it. That's also something very compelling, and this isn't in my notes, but I thought of it 30 minutes ago, Bonhoeffer talks about this in Life Together, doesn't he? That we don't, that the community of saints, would have been his language, is not something we generate or create. It's a gift we participate in. And how freeing is that? What good news is that? Again, for us workaholic Protestants who think we just have to manufacture and engineer and constantly innovate to sort of make these things happen. The kingdom is here. It's arrived. It's obtained. We're participants in it, not creators of it. And then the third thing as to why we so often fail at this, we forget that habits must be cultivated over the long haul. Right? If worship is therapy for our addictions and our pathologies, it takes a long time to get better. So we can have a little patience. Patience, not complacency, but patience. That's another virtue, right? That's another fruit of the Spirit. We can be patient with ourselves. And I'm going to say another word in a minute about taking the long view in this, that this is work for the long haul, not something that's instant. But again, so much about our church culture is about instant results, right? And if you don't produce instantly, you're going to get moved on, especially if you're Methodist, right? They're going to put you somewhere else, put somebody else in there to get instant results. How to cultivate patience and see this as the work of a lifetime. And it also occurs to me that we forget sometimes in our own anxiety and our disappointment, our rightful disappointment about our failures, we forget that the church is always going to be subject to pettiness and small-mindedness, which are the opposites of gratitude and generosity, since the church is comprised of people, right? I mean, we're human. We mess up. We get it wrong. We are petty. We are small. And that interesting reality that God has decided to make a church out of people in all our frailties and in all our faults. And we forget that sometimes. We expect a kind of perfection that can't be possible. So where is there hope? Again, three places where we might find hope. Where our failure is evident, and it's evident all around us, grace is always more evident and more present. And I think we just don't trust that enough. Again, we want to trust in our own power, in our own creativity and cleverness. But it's all grace, right? God's grace is sufficient. It's only by God's own grace and power in our lives that any of this comes to fruition, that we glimpse even the smallest gesture of gratitude or generosity. It's God's work, God's grace. It's grace, all the way down. So that's one place where there's hope, is just to rest in that truth and to take some comfort in the fact that it's the working of God's Spirit through grace, sacramental grace, through the grace that comes to us that will accomplish this. And a second place where there's hope, again, in having confidence in the truth that God will do this transforming work in our lives as we make ourselves available to it. We cooperate with God. We don't co-opt God's work. It's a posture of cooperation, not co-optation. Right? And again, I know I'm sort of beating the dead horse of our workaholic culture. This is a truth we can kind of rest in. That the grace that comes to us is grace we cooperate with, not something we manufacture. So having confidence in the truth that God will do the transforming work if we make ourselves available to it. And if we create the conditions in our communities where people are available to that. And then the third way where we see hope, coming back to this idea of the long haul, the long view, and this is where I want to close. There's hope in taking the long view on this, that the formation we undergo as the body of Christ is work for a lifetime. It happens in fits and starts. There are disappointments and there are small victories. And in my experience, almost all the victories are small. But we give thanks for those small victories. So there's hope when we take the long view, when we're not consumed with the idea that success must be instantaneous, right? And so with that in mind, this idea that grace is always more present than we think, that our call is simply to make ourselves available to the working of that grace, and in taking the long view, there is hope for this transformation into communities of gratitude and generosity. With all of that in mind, I want to end with a prayer, and I expect most of you have heard it or used it or said it yourselves. It's familiar. It was written by Oscar Romero, Archbishop of El Salvador, martyred while celebrating the Eucharist in 1980. And I come back to this prayer myself again and again in all kinds of contexts, and it strikes me as a worthy set of petitions for our own thinking about what it means to cultivate communities of gratitude and generosity out of the experience of the liturgy and worship. So let me pray this for us, and let us hear it together. And then I'll reiterate that question for consideration that we talked about, and as time allows, or as our table fellowship makes possible, maybe you can share some of the places where you've seen this at work in your life. But here's the prayer by Oscar Romero. And it's really a bit of a poem, too. It helps now and then to step back and take the long view. The kingdom is not only beyond our efforts, it is beyond our vision. We accomplish in our lifetime only a tiny fraction of the magnificent enterprise that is God's work. Nothing we do is complete, which is another way of saying that the kingdom always lies beyond us. No statement says all that could be said. No prayer fully expresses our faith. No confession brings perfection. No pastoral visit brings wholeness. No program accomplishes the church's mission. No set of goals and objectives includes everything. This is what we are about. We plant seeds that one day will grow. We water seeds already planted, knowing that they hold future promise. We lay foundations that will need further development. We provide yeast that produces effects beyond our capacities. We cannot do everything, and there is a sense of liberation in realizing that. This enables us to do something, and to do it very well. It may be incomplete, but it is a beginning, a step along the way, an opportunity for God's grace to enter and do the rest. We may never see the results, but that is the difference between the master builder and the worker. We are workers, not master builders, ministers, not messiahs. We are prophets of a future, not our own. Amen. And again, as opportunity arises, specifically, concretely, where have you seen gratitude and generosity lived out in your own ecclesial settings? Where do you see hope for that?
We have a whole half hour before the break.
We do?
We're ahead.
Then we could talk about that now
so
for a few minutes.
You could either say more, or we could turn to the table groups, and not only...